Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome again to week whatever this is, five, I think, of Building the Good Life for All, Transforming Income Inequality in Our Communities. We looked last week at the second strategy of four for helping Alice and Alec. Alice and Alec are people who are asset limited, income constrained, employed. So a specific set of people that we are engaging with here. And we are looking at four strategies for helping to transform the reality of income inequality in our communities so that they and we can flourish together, because our flourishing depends on one another. So our four strategies are relief. That's sort of the immediate charity, the most easily identifiable approach to income inequality. There is self-help, which is what we talked about last week. This week we'll talk about cultural formation. Next week we'll talk about advocacy and governmental action. Shannon is making the case that we need all four of these strategies because they are all useful in their own way. They all have their own drawbacks, and so we need a combination effort here. We looked last week at at self-help, which is the process of developing the skills and capacities and opportunities that people need in order to better their own situation. So that's everything is with an eye towards sort of a long-term change in people's situations, not simply a short-term remedy. So even when we talked about charity, we were trying to talk about charity in a way that would aim for long-term change in people's situations. Cultural formation today, this is the process of kind of shaping the way that our common life works. Not through official means, but through sort of the way that we have an impact on attitudes and ideas and habits in the world around us. And again, this is specifically written for churches. And so this is sort of the guiding question here is, how do we as a church community have the ability to shape the culture around us? Developing a culture that promotes the flourishing of all people includes policies and initiatives by businesses, voluntary associations, or actions on behalf of certain classes of people, women, LGBT persons, low-wage workers, or tenants, fighting for their rights. The strategy of cultural formation depends on persuasion and influence more than direct action. It happens at a community level where values are shaped and people are socialized. How our government handles issues is influenced by our opinions. So as an example, one example is how the U.S. tax code treats charitable giving. He was writing this before the changes in the tax law, so that is not the topic here. The U.S. tax code's treatment of charitable giving encourages voluntary giving to churches and other organizations by making those contributions deductible from your taxes, which reflects a cultural value that giving is worthwhile. So that's an example of the way that cultural attitudes shape the ways that things work in the rest of the world. Similarly, this is outside of government, at least in a direct sense. Similarly, businesses often provide benefits that enable people to improve their quality of life. So health insurance, life insurance, and so forth. We spent some time last week talking about a Starbucks initiative that allowed employees to have tuition-free college as a benefit of their employment at Starbucks. Now, full disclosure, the president of Starbucks, who is being quoted here, is Howard Schultz. This was also prior to a couple of weeks ago, right? So, so Schultz says that businesses have a responsibility to their publics. When he says that, he is expressing a value and trying to influence public opinion. So the idea that Starbucks has a responsibility to anyone who is not presently ordering a latte, that is an attempt by Starbucks as a business to influence public opinion and to act out their own values. So in this chapter, we focus on the ways in which cultural values can rebalance the forces that have disadvantaged Alice. First, we look at movements for fair wages. The Fair Food Program of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers is a group using public pressure to influence change. This is a group that began as a representative for tomato pickers, many of whom are immigrants, and they pressed for a penny a pound raise for the tomato pickers, and also for legislation that would improve their working and living conditions. The extra penny per pound, which doesn't sound like very much to those of us on the purchasing end of tomatoes, the extra penny per pound wouldn't come out of the growers' profits, but from corporate buyers like groceries and restaurant chains. For workers in the tomato fields, a penny a pound and other changes are huge. They amount to time clocks, outdoor shade, and 80 extra bucks a week. Some of the actors in that process included the Presbyterian Church USA, which endorsed a boycott of a large grocery chain in Florida because they didn't join the Fair Food Program that would have paid this extra penny a pound to the tomato pickers. This is a fine example of ethical consumerism, by which consumers press for conditions and wages that benefit workers. Directed consumer demand by individuals and organizations, including churches, can make a difference. Now we sort of broaden to developing social capital. In chapters 3 and 4, that was strategies 1 and 2, we were able to point to tangible actions and programs. Now we come to this community-wide, perhaps nationwide intangible called culture. Culture or public opinion begins on this neighborhood level where neighbors can cooperate with neighbors for mutual benefit. The term we use for that is social capital, that ability for neighborhoods to come together. Social capital means a network of social organizations and relationships that develop relationships and social trust. Social capital has evaporated in the gap between the advantages enjoyed by the upwardly mobile rich and the disadvantages experienced by the downwardly mobile working class. This sort of fractionalization by income worsens Alice's situation. Location matters. One's place of residence can intensify the harmful effects of a culture of lower income households. Sociologist Charles Murray discovered in looking at location that there were pockets of affluence and pockets of disadvantage that tended to reinforce the norms of the community, whether those norms were disruptive of self-improvement or not. The influence of housing itself is hard to overestimate. The need for stability in one's life goes beyond the physical necessity for shelter, but being able to count on continuity in the place where one lives is a cultural value as well. Good neighbors nurture success. In the middle to late 1990s, the federal government studied the impact of an experiment, Moving to Opportunity, in which low-income families entered a lottery that enabled them to move to better neighborhoods. They found that the number of years living in a better neighborhood made quite a difference. So the actual move itself was less important than the amount of time that you spent being plugged into a better neighborhood. If preteens moved to a more income-integrated neighborhood, they went on to earn 31% more in their mid-20s. So this is an effect 15 years on than those who did not have the chance to move. They were also more likely to attend college. The effects of growing up in, we'll put quotes around this, better locations persisted over several generations. Note what might happen if a neighborhood group decided to reclaim their neighborhood. If they said, this neighborhood is going to change in a positive way. As they began to work, they would build a social momentum that ideally would begin to reverse the norm of letting properties or relationships erode. Working class people can form groups that can generate social capital. Businesses can impact culture for better and for worse. A fascinating development is the process of churches helping to establish businesses that improve communities. Nearly 45 big American corporations have teamed up to offer 100,000 jobs for unemployed people ages 16 to 24. A number of retailers are reforming their policies toward progressive wages, advance notice of assigned shifts, better training, and other incentives for employees. There are clear advantages for businesses that treat their employees well. Here, a study by a couple of professors, one from the MIT Sloan School of Business and one from Harvard Business School, found that employers that treated their employees well had work that was more efficient and more fulfilling, costs were lower, sales and profits escalated, and customer satisfaction improved. The prevailing wisdom has been that paying higher minimum wages would result in lower employment because employers would not be able to afford to pay as many workers. A study looked at what happened when New Jersey raised its minimum wage and Pennsylvania did not, so neighboring states with similar types of economies. The study found that raising the minimum wage had a positive effect on employment. Business leaders who understand that addressing Alex's situation is good for business are growing in number. The strategy of cultural action can seem distant from us, but a softer but ultimately more influential course of action for us as churches may be the persuasive power of what we buy week in and week out. Encouraging others in churches to investigate income inequality through sermons or adult forums, for example, by studying this book, are other ways of exploring how to address the issues that Alice faces. I'm sure that at this point it is clear that none of the four strategies are totally separated from the others. There are elements of each of the four in many innovative and creative programs working with people to achieve a flourishing life situation. So there is your summary for the week. So a question for you. How do the groups that you belong to influence public opinion?
Well, to break the silence, I joined the Kiwanis Club 4 years ago now, and they focus a lot on children and benefiting kids, but they also seem to like to have a picture in the paper telling West Des Moines, especially, Kiwanis Club of West Des Moines, what they're doing in West Des Moines. You know, you got to kind of toot your own horn or let the general public know what you're doing, and not just do it and feel good about it, but not have others unaware of it. So mm-hmm. that's one group I'm a member of. And as far as I think most of the groups, I'm a big believer on they vote, they go to the ballot, they go to put ballots in the ballot box.
They Kiwanis specifically, or
no? I mean, I have a higher percentage of people that vote. It always amazes me in national elections how many people don't vote in the U.S. No, I guess I've always kind of been around. My dad always donated blood. I donate blood. My dad always voted, and I've never been called to jury duty. And I vote all the time.
You should vote more, apparently.
I vote all the time.
Make the reputation of me being a hanging judge or something, but that's just two quick ones I can think of. You gotta go to the people that have the politicians and the elected officials that really have some can make some major changes.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about actually going to the elected officials who can make the changes, governmental changes next week. So come back.
Okay.
No, you're not, right? Well, listen to the podcast.
I'm going to be in a late.
But the sort of the cultural value that goes, that sort of underpins the cultural value of voting, right? That we're going to develop as a value that you will go vote, right? And not just once every 4 years, right? That's a place where some cultural formation makes a difference. Okay, here's another terrible corporate citizen trying to do something that is either good or at least makes them look good in the eyes of their customers. Facebook is always like very on top of, we're going to tell you it's election day in the place where you are, and you know, here's a temporary profile picture you can put up that says, hey, I went and voted. And, so they're engaged in that piece of cultural formation. Now, they're engaged in all kinds of other pieces of cultural formation that I do not endorse. On the other hand, I'm on Facebook all the time. So there's me. But there is, you know, that's a sort of trying to shift a cultural value toward voting. This idea of, you know, Kiwanis making sure they get their picture in the paper when they're doing the good things. Now, full disclosure, right about exactly an hour from now, I'm going to read Matthew chapter 6 to you all, where Jesus says, be really careful about practicing your piety in front of others in order to be seen by them, because I tell you, you have already received your reward. And so there's a piece of the gospel, right? Jesus standing on a mountain talking to us is saying, don't get your picture in the paper when you do the awesome things. But there is a positive effect of getting your picture in the paper doing awesome things. It depends on knowing your audience, right? If your audience is people who might come join Kiwanis or donate to your church or whatever it is for your own purposes, that's a bad reason to get your picture in the paper. But if your purpose is to say, look what you could do too, right? We can make this difference. Gene, you could make this difference too. Then maybe there's some value in having your picture in the paper, right? Because that's where that cultural formation, that's one of the places that cultural formation goes on. This is awkward that this chapter landed on this day in the scripture readings.
Just as a follow-up to that, I think it points out to a lot of people who do not live in West Des Moines, think everybody in West Des Moines is pretty wealthy.
Right.
And I think the more that we put, you know, there's lots of needs in West Des Moines.
Yeah.
And I saw in the paper this last week, 15 homes that sold for more than $1 million. You know, it's mind-boggling to think that there is so much wealth Mm-hmm. But I think and how we got branded that way, maybe it's when we built that brand new football field that's nicer than most colleges. But I think it helps even to the members of, or the residents of West Des Moines. There's lots of things going on to help people in need right here. And so I don't know whether that's really influencing public opinion as much as educating the West Des Moines public.
An educated public opinion is generally going to do better at this than an uneducated public opinion.
Yeah.
Make them aware of the needs.
Yeah.
So maybe when they do go vote on, well, we got a 1 cent sales tax deal coming up in March. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting to see if they're willing to.
And there are pros and cons to, for instance, a 1 cent sales tax, governmental action, but. How we think about those pros and cons is a cultural value, right? How do we think about the benefits and trade-offs of in that case, a governmental policy that positively affects the community as a whole, tends to take a larger percentage of the income of those who have less income. That's how sales taxes work. They are regressive, in an economic sense. But they also draw revenue from people who don't live in the community. So there's a lot of trade-offs there. The way that we think about making those trade-offs, right? The way that we think about whom are we trying to benefit. Who are we willing to say needs to bear the cost, right? Those are the cultural values. What prevents groups of neighbors from rehabilitating their neighborhood and building social capital? And how could our church assist in shaping cultural values for the flourishing of neighborhoods near us, within our sphere? What prevents groups of neighbors from building social capital?
Would you define social capital?
Yeah, social capital is that network of relationships that on the one hand bonds people together. So the fact that we all sort of know each other and can assume certain things about each other because we actually know, right? Like we have background to know. Stacy's going to give a certain kind of response to a certain kind of situation because of her medical background, because of her parenting status, because of just what we know about her personality, right? We know each other that well, I know that Stacy's the one I would call in certain situations. Marilyn is the person I would call in other situations. So we as a group have this level of social capital. It can function in a bonding sense like this, where we are, right now we are building bonding social capital because we're getting to know each other better through this conversation. It can also work in a bridging sense. So if I need someone to, help me get a foothold into the school administration, I'm gonna call you because I know you know people in school administration. You also just know how it works. And so you've got some skills that I could use that I can even call on because we have that relationship. And so you can actually get me beyond myself in that way. So social capital is that sort of that sense of neighborhood, whether that's geographical, religious in our case, or in other ways. So social capital is what we often say we're missing it's a word for what we often describe as missing when we talk about how neighbors don't know each other. Does that help?
I think fear prevents us.
Yeah.
A lot of people not knowing, what that might bring to your neighborhood. I can understand it, but then get to know, I think.
Yeah, so that sort of first introduction to your neighbor is frightening.
In some neighborhoods, the people who live there are busy just trying to survive.
Right, yeah.
They don't have time to think about how can they improve things.
Right, yeah. So there's a real lack of discretionary time in a lot of neighborhoods.
And money.
And discretionary income, yeah. And sometimes lack of discretionary time and lack of discretionary money track together. Sometimes they actually offset each other. And sometimes I think a barrier to us as churches recognizing how we might partner with a neighborhood is if we are thinking of discretionary income and forgetting about discretionary time. I think we can often miss real assets in a neighborhood around us.
We Marilyn. Did. I think it might have been in the 80s. We did some ministries with improving housing, mm-hmm. and we were involved with Anaheim Housing, which is still active.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the neighborhood and worked. We did not work with residents, but we worked with the rehabbing agency, which was.
Okay.
Anaheim.
Uh-huh.
And then we tried our hand at adopting a homeless family. We were aware that there were families that were coming out of shelters that needed housing, and we bought a unit in West Des Moines and housed a family. And that was, these are all learning experiences.
Sure.
That was... did not prove after 4 or 5 years to be really successful in that we did not have the social service skills. We were aligned with Anaheim, but it's really hard to have that serving agency in the central city and our family out here. So we, just in terms of background, we thought that maybe it was better to go to the neighborhood and serve family. So as we think about what our local mission's going to be, we've had a lot of experiences, let's say. Mm-hmm. You remember those most of
them? Oh, yes.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and so that that sort of that distance from needed services, the services that sort of would allow for that self-help, right? See how these strategies become interconnected. The distance from those services also contributes to a lack of the social capital that one needs in order to move forward. Yeah.
Well, that's a good example of social capital. We didn't have
any. Right. We didn't have the social capital that we needed to help them. Yeah.
That's a great example.
Yeah, and those are relationships that we're talking about. And when you said, you know, we were working in a neighborhood with a service provider agency rather than directly with residents of the neighborhood, you know, there's a place where we've, you know, where we took one path rather than a different path, and that had some effect on the social capital that was developed or not developed in that situation. Stacy mentioned last week, as we were talking about self-development, and the fact of transience in neighborhoods, that neighborhoods are especially lower income neighborhoods, also lower age neighborhoods, which are often very similar, but especially lower income neighborhoods, people are moving in and out often very quickly. They may not own the homes that they're living in. And so there are factors there that contribute to turnover in the neighborhood, which tends to erode social capital. So if we want to talk about social capital, one of the things that we're talking about is how long can people stay in a given living situation? This is also true of young neighborhoods, right? You know, people in their 20s and 30s are often moving several times faster than you all may have moved when you were in your 20s and 30s, and certainly more often than you all move now, right? So there's an age effect, there's a generation effect, there's an economic effect that can lead to real constant churn in neighborhoods, and that makes it difficult to establish social capital, which erodes one of the ways that people can advance their situations. I do want to point to one way that we can and do express a social value that does benefit the neighbors around us, and I'm holding it, right? We go out of our way to purchase coffee that is grown by people we more or less know, and particularly to purchase coffee that pays fairly the people who grew that coffee. And we don't do that because the market demands it, right? Instead, we tell the market what to demand. We tell the market that we want to pay more for coffee. And we specifically want the more we pay for coffee to go to growers in El Salvador. And so coffee is one of those markets that has actually been really kind of transformed by the way that consumer attitudes have shifted and have said, okay, we really, really like coffee, but more and more want to buy coffee from people who are going to pay the growers of that coffee an adequate rate for what they did. So that's actually a place, you know, there weren't really boycotts in the coffee market the way that there were, say, in the tomato market. There has been a lot of pressure that has actually raised the overall price of coffee. We still buy it like crazy, but the overall market price for coffee has gone up in ways that have benefited a lot of people, even when we don't buy specifically Don Justo, which you should. But that's a place where we have shaped a cultural value. Let's talk about employment. I think I may have actually sort of glanced over a few of the pieces of this in the chapter itself, so you can go back and read a little bit more about these thoughts. But tell me about how cultural attitudes about employment have changed during your career. And these can be positive changes or negative changes. And then I will allow you to say how you would want to change today's values about employment.
Well, I haven't been retired 15 years. You know, my career is in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they publicly indicate that young people graduating college today will typically change employment more readily, where my grandfather might have stayed with one company forever, mm-hmm. never had but one employer.
Right.
That is not going to happen.
Right.
And when is it appropriate to move, and when do I become a job hopper?
Uh-huh.
See, back in my era, he doesn't seem to stay any.
Right.
Reasons for that, that didn't stay too long. But I had a little of that going on. Well, my longest tenure any place was at DMAC.
Uh-huh.
And that was late in my career. But I got restless, and I think I'm going to move. Then all of a sudden, you know. But now they don't expect. Is it 5 years? Is it a long time in this era for somebody to stay with an employer?
And that's with an employer, even with some internal promotion during that time, or internal job changes. Promotion isn't always even the right word for it. There are a lot of lateral moves.
Yeah.
So 5 years is probably about a decent stretch with a given employer these days.
That doesn't apply to pastors, though.
No, of course not. Yeah.
But see, they say he's a job hopper.
Right.
So if you didn't stay, you know, like I say, the idea of somebody, these college students just break mm-hmm. out laughing.
Right.
Well, employer for life.
Right.
That's archaic.
Right. And it's not only changes from, you know, financial firm to financial firm, or from, you know, from manufacturing office to manufacturing office, but it's a change between careers as well. Not necessarily every 5 years, but The average millennial will have several different careers over there, what we used to call a career.
Yeah.
So completely different job fields, not simply different employers. Yeah.
Well, the common attitude among employers, especially fairly large companies, used to be that, you'd accept an employee,
mm-hmm.
and if that person worked well, you'd basically take care of them the rest of their lives.
Right.
Establish a pension plan, and there's advancement for opportunities for advancement. And that's all changed now.
Right, yeah. So the corporate, sort of the corporate employment structure has changed. The corporate benefits structure has changed. The defined benefit pension plan is effectively gone in almost every field. Replaced now by defined contribution plans, which, you know, there are some actual, you know, some pros to that, right? But there are some cons to that. One of the cons is related to, I don't think it necessarily made this shift, I think it's more in response to it, but the idea that the company doesn't have a long-term interest in you.
Right.
Well, the yeah.
The common attitude used to be you get a good employee,
mm-hmm.
and if that employee remains a good employee, you mm-hmm. take good care of them because
right.
it's an asset to the company.
Right.
Now, most seems to me that most corporations, it's people are interchangeable, warm bodies.
Uh-huh.
We got an employee, you know, don't need him, we'll always find somebody else.
Right. Yeah. So, Bob, you wanted to get in too.
Well, I was going to say that, in, particularly in the data area, I think there is a big emphasis on not being an employee.
Yeah.
Individual self-employed. He's got a contract for this gig and
right.
this company for something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're virtually self-employed.
Right.
Now that creates problems for benefits,
mm-hmm.
for pension.
Right. Yeah. And so it's that's one of those pro and con things, right?
That individual doesn't have the discipline or the financial means.
Right.
Benefits, that doesn't happen.
Right.
Suddenly you're without insurance, health insurance.
Right.
You have no retirement put together.
Right. And so you can see, just sort of take that shift to, you know, that shift away from, what, from W-2 employees to 1099 contractors, right? And they're doing the same work. They've got the same sort of productivity for the company. Let's just assume all of that, right? Now, there may be situationally really good productivity reasons to hire somebody in a certain way rather than another way. But let's assume, you know, somebody's writing code for a computer program and they could either do that, you know, in a cubicle as a regular employee or honestly still in a cubicle, but nominally a contractor. That individual has just actually picked up a fair degree of autonomy under the laws that regulate whether you're an employee or a contractor. The company doesn't necessarily want to give them that autonomy, but maybe they do. Maybe, let's assume that too, right? That individual has picked up some autonomy around that, some autonomy around where they're going. The company has picked up the ability to care less about that employee in the financial ways that we are used to companies caring about employees. They're going to offer less in the way of benefits because they're not talking to an employee anymore. They're talking to a contractor. And so, you know, everything from tax withholding to health care to retirement, all of that lands on the individual, not on the corporation. Maybe that's a good trade-off for certain roles, certain people. But it's a trade-off, right? And I think it's likely that there are some really bad trade-offs out there. And here's my bias. Generally, I'm going to assume that the bigger economic actor is getting away with more than the smaller economic actor. So if I'm going to be a contractor for Facebook, right, which makes like $17 billion a second, and I don't, right? I'm getting a very small piece of their pie, and I don't have a very big lever that I can pull. So there's a cultural change, right, in the way that companies work. Compare that to that the example of Starbucks giving tuition-free college to its employees who work more than 20 hours a week. Now, there is no way on earth that you could define a barista as a 1099 contractor, right? The employment law simply does not allow that. Whether someone can get away with it or not is a different question. But there's an investment in actually the forward progress of that individual, right? An investment by the company in the forward progress of the individual who is no longer going to work for them, right? But they weren't going to continue working for Starbucks anyway. So what you're doing is you're motivating someone to, A, stay with your company for probably longer than they otherwise would. Employee turnover in food service is well above 100%. So on average, an employee is going to stay with you for 6 months, 9 months maybe. If you can keep them with you for 2 years, 4 years as they pursue a degree, even if you're paying for the degree, you're probably saving money on the employee because even at that level, replacing an employee is expensive. Replacing a highly skilled employee in a white-collar job is super expensive. So there's a place where there's an economic incentive. There's also a cultural incentive. I am not running for president, but I think you could identify there. The idea that there's a cultural value being played out, comparable even to the cultural value that when you get your foot in the door with a big company and work for that company for the next, 40 years or whatever, then you get to retire from that company with a pension, right? That's a value, that you're going to enter a company and they will take care of you through to the end. The idea that you're going to work for a company for a very short period of time, but they're going to do you good while you're there, is also a value.
Well, it's also a value to the company because you have a better opinion of them. You're
right.
Going to do a better job.
Right.
Especially a barista who interacts with the public all the time.
Right.
They're going to be a better face of the company.
Yeah. And I have a much higher opinion of Starbucks than their coffee or their real estate practices deserve.
And we're talking about Starbucks in a positive fashion.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about Caribou Coffee.
Right, yeah. Which is actually also, from what I understand, a fairly good corporate citizen. They didn't make the book, is the problem.
I don't know. Never heard of them.
In that context, yeah.
Well, so. Walmart, I can remember the days where I would not even go in a Walmart because it was the general feeling that they, or the knowledge that they did not pay their employees well enough. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that phase of their development. But now they're coming into very positive light here, and I'm really impressed. I might just go in to Walmart.
Right.
But really, that's, you know, they have negative social, what do you call it, social...
A negative capital. Effect on social capital, yeah.
Yeah.
And so you were describing sort of living out your own values by saying, I don't want to go in that, I don't want to patronize that store because I don't think that they are living up to my values, right? So so that's one of the places, and that's where Shannon says, you know, churches have a really great sort of economic footprint. And you could think about the economic footprint that we have as Covenant Presbyterian, and it's a whole lot bigger than our church budget, right? Because I don't know what y'all make, but you don't give all your money to the church. I know that for sure, just counting people in the room. So you've got a much bigger footprint outside Covenant's budget than inside Covenant's budget. And so this question is framed as economic impact. What's our church's economic impact? But I can say, what's our economic impact and social impact? How could our economic and social impact as the church be used to shape public opinion?
I think you have to be a little bit, my biggest concern on doing some of these things is that one of the things is we're not big enough. Sustainability
okay.
becomes a big issue. Mm-hmm. A lot of the kinds of things that when your original question is what groups do you get involved in, I'm not involved other than here, mm-hmm. Or Presbytery, mm-hmm. involved in any particular group that gets involved that way. But in every time in the paper, they'll be listing places where they're looking for volunteers, or on outside groups that you can get involved in on your own. One of the biggest things I've noticed is, and I think it's a cultural thing, is you don't discuss with friends and neighbors religion, politics, or finance.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, if you're not going to talk to people, then how do you know where they're coming from? I'm not going to walk up to two or three of my neighbors and tell them what side of the political spectrum I'm on. They probably know anyway, but...
Those yard signs give them
the yard signs do it. Yeah. Yeah. Especially in Ashworth and 29. Yeah. The giant ones. Yeah, but there, you know, as right. you go up and down the street, you've got a neighborhood. I can't uh-huh. see our neighborhood collectively doing much but still arguing with each other. So the biggest cultural change I think that needs to be made is to get rid of the tribalism and start being able to visit.
Yeah. So let me offer that as a piece of our social impact. And, okay, here's your assignment if you're a reader. So you guys have a book, so you get to get out of this. But don't get out of this. Read chapter 6 for next week. But better assignment, and I think it's supposed to snow again this coming week, so here's a great opportunity, actually. Have a conversation with your neighbors about something other than whether it's snowing or not, and about something other than politics, right? Not that you can't talk about politics with your neighbors, but if you only talk about politics with your neighbors, you're not actually building the same kind of relationship you otherwise might. But have a conversation with a neighbor you don't know. I have neighbors I don't know. So most of us living in little grids have 8 neighbors, right? One on either side, one right behind us, one across the street, and then there's 4 corners, right? You could get to know those 8 neighbors, build a little neighborhood there, get to know something about them other than whose yard sign they have, and start to re-knit some of the social fabric that actually lets us recognize that we are interconnected with each other. So there's your assignment while you're out snowblowing Thursday morning.
Looking at that, the second bullet, what is your church's economic impact?
Yeah.
It dawned on me that I've got some people I've worked with in Utah, that influence of the Mormon church.
Yeah.
Especially in Salt Lake City. If you are going to sell cars, if you're going to be a doctor, all those things tended to be connected with, are you part of the Mormon church?
Right, yeah. So there are places where a given church will have this sort of overwhelming cultural impact. Don't underestimate the cultural impact of Christianity still. The institutional church is a very different thing, culturally speaking, than it used to be. But as a cultural voice, you know, when there's a moral or ethical situation in the news, and they need to talk to someone about the ethical implications of it, they're going to find a Christian pastor. And they're not necessarily going to get a good answer, in my opinion, but they're going to find a Christian pastor to ask about that. Y'all are members of a Christian church. So we have a lot more sort of cultural impact in that way than we think we do. Okay, see you next week.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.